We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Provisioning the larder, preparing meals, coming together to enjoy meals and talk over the day's events. In these rituals, we learn manners, how to lend a hand, and we practice the art of conversation. As adults in these rituals, we pass on these skills to the next generation. Today, we're going to take a look at what we learn through the rituals of food and what they mean in our social and political lives. Our guest this afternoon is political scientist Janet Flemming, the author of The Taste for Civilization, Food, Politics, and Civil Society. Her book focuses, in her words, on the importance of civility to American democracy and how civility is related to everyday food practices, both at the table and in the wider arenas of public gardens and markets. Professor Flemming also says at the outset of The Taste for Civilization, our opportunities for everyday civility in speech and practice have declined in our fast-paced consumer workaholic culture. She says we would do well to reflect on the importance of our food rituals and make time for them. Listeners, what are your thoughts? I welcome your comments and questions this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Janet Flemming is professor and chair of political science at Santa Clara University. Her previous books include Women's Political Voice, How Women Are Transforming the Practice and Study of Politics, The Taste for Civilization, Food, Politics, and Civil Society, is published by the University of Illinois Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with us, toll-free 800-222-9455. Janet Flemming, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for inviting me. Pleasure to be here.
So what kind of response did you get from people when you told them you were working on this project?
That's a great question. Puzzlement. It's interesting. It seems so ordinary and commonplace that we should take daily food seriously, but most people didn't connect everyday food practices to civility and democracy, and so I enjoyed putting those three pieces together. Since I'm a political scientist and someone who studies the women's movement, which tends to look for politics in different places, I enjoyed putting together just the ability to develop the art of conversation at the table and how in politics that's what diplomacy is, being able to civilly disagree, and yet being puzzled why we never made these connections before. So I must admit, most people were rather puzzled by my putting these pieces together.
Yeah. But once the conversation ensued, what kinds of things came up? How did people think about food rituals and how they get to the table?
I think the sense is that this is an enormously powerful part of who we all are. And particularly the women I spoke to, they just said it was like light bulbs going off, like the how important this is and how so many women feel that they have less and less time to do it and they feel conflicted and they don't feel they have time for the meals and the conversations that they experienced as children. And so a lot of I guess, giving permission to start taking these kinds of concerns seriously and figuring out what to do about it.
Yeah. One of the interesting people that readers will find in the book is a sociologist by the name of Marjorie DeVault.
Yes.
And she did some interviews with men and women in Chicago about the work of feeding the family.
Mm-hmm.
And someone told her, although meal preparation time was bounded, you know, or maybe these are your words, meal preparation time is bounded. In other words, there's a start and finish to it. Strategizing for it extends throughout the day.
Yes. In fact, I really enjoyed the adoption of her word food work. That food work is something that really does occupy people all day long, because you have to think about upcoming meals and strategize and plan, because meals just don't suddenly appear on a table. So I think, and it's been invisible. And I think that a lot of women lead their lives thinking, oh, it's very easy to put all the stuff on the table, and it's no big deal. And they discount themselves the amount of work it takes. And yet, ironically, they sort of resent then when people don't take the time to appreciate all the work it takes to put food on the table, and the notion of there sort of being an economy of gratitude, that we keep this little unconscious record of, well, who thanked me for what I just did, and why didn't they appreciate what I just did? And the fact it does take a lot of strategizing, and it's more work than is commonly recognized.
Yeah, we take it for granted.
Definitely.
But food, water, and shelter are at the top of what we need to survive as human beings.
Right. And I think that it's important to sort of take a look at who has been doing this important work. And as women have entered the workforce, of course, you know, they have less time to do it. And so who's going to pick it up, and who should pick it up? And, of course, I'm arguing that all household members should, and see it as important. And it does take time, but it's a good use of time. When you think of other ways you could spend your time, why has this lost importance, and maybe it should regain the importance that I think many people recognize. If you just think of, why do we go to all the trouble to relocate on Thanksgiving? We travel all over the country to be together at a table. And so there's something going on that's extremely important to us that happens that should be acknowledged and shared.
Are feminists looking into the issues we're talking about this afternoon?
That's a really good question. As you probably know, most of the writings of the second wave feminist was get out of the kitchen as fast as you can, because what really mattered was work and achieving in the male world of education and employment. And I think feminists are rethinking. That's what sort of prompted me to write the book, is women really feel ground between, I want to achieve and I want to earn money, and yet someone's got to do the food work. And we know from studies that typically it's still women's responsibility. There's a lot.
Professor Fleming, do we have you there? I think we've lost our guest. So what we'll do is we'll reconnect with our guest this afternoon, Janet Fleming, and we'll get her back on the line in just a moment or two. Let me remind you that our guest this afternoon is a political scientist. Her name is Janet Fleming. She is professor and chair of political science at Santa Clara University, and she's the author most recently of The Taste for Civilization, Food, Politics, and Civil Society. This afternoon, we're taking a look at what we learn through the rituals of food and what they mean in our social and political lives. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. In addition to The Taste for Civilization, Janet Fleming is the author of Women's Political Voice, How Women Are Transforming the Practice and Study of Politics. And we've got her back on the line. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened, but
me too. Sorry.
That's okay. So where were we talking about feminists and
right.
And how are they thinking about these issues, and what are they thinking?
Well, My sense is that that this is sort of a new form of feminist thinking, to go back and look at domesticity and the household, which have been so criticized, but I think it's important to go back and look at the household and look at the importance of what went on there, because if feminism is supposed to look at the quality of women's lives, and women really are feeling ground between work demands and wanting to have this, the importance of food and food rituals for their families and their friends. So I think this is a rather new area.
Yeah. In the late 1970s, I had the pleasure of meeting Betty Friedan.
Mm-hmm.
And she was talking about this,
mm-hmm.
interestingly enough. She was talking about domestic work,
mm-hmm.
and her vision was it should be spread out, and it should be done well, and it should be celebrated.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, if you look at the original now Declaration of Rights from 1968, the revolution was supposed to be women went to the workforce and men came into the house. So in a way, it's the revolution is half complete, and in a way, this is sort of taking a look at that other half of it, and of course challenging the male definition of what an ideal worker is, which is someone who will work very, very long hours and put, you know, this kind of activity second. So in a way, it's always been part of the agenda. I think now it's just really come to the fore.
Yeah. Well, we're going to speak in generalities here, but that's, I guess, all we can do. What role do children and men play today in domestic chores? Do we know?
Well, yes, we know that men are increasingly participating. As you know, the recent recession has meant an awful lot of men are losing their jobs, and they are pitching in more for that reason. I mean, it's a unfortunate reason, but it's leading to this consequence. Children are definitely being exposed to this through school gardens, which are increasing all over the country. Growing food and sharing it is seen as part of curricula in grade schools, where they learn not only the science and biology of food, but also the cultural importance of food preparation and sharing. And that is really breaking down the old gender expectations about only women do food.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about school gardens, community gardens that are springing up, gardens in jail yards and in prisons, the first family's garden, and then we've got the slow food movement and farmers markets? Is this going to stick with us, or is this something else?
I think when I first thought about this book, I didn't know for sure, but I am increasingly convinced that it is here to stay. All the evidence of school gardens is they're growing, so to speak. They're increasing in numbers, and jail gardens are increasing in numbers, and the data show less recidivism of inmates who participate in gardens. Community gardens are growing. Farmers markets are growing. So membership in the slow food movement is growing. So they're all on upward trends. And I think particularly as the literature about unhealthy food versus healthy food is becoming more and more read by the general population, people want to experiment with like a little garden plot in their backyard or some, you know, growing tomatoes on their verandas, and so that as the whole criticism of corporate fast food is gaining leadership, I think that all these alternatives are, my read is they're all on an upward trend.
Yeah, well, we're certainly seeing more attention paid to what's going on in school lunchrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are concerns about the food that's being served there and the length of the school lunch break. What do you see on the horizon in that regard?
Well, certainly all the information about the obesity crisis has sent the alarm about children's lunches in schools, and that's a place, obviously, where government can intervene to try to be at least one place where they can sort of control what food children are exposed to. The length of lunch is interesting because schools are under enormous pressure with No Child Left Behind and various teach to the test kinds of pressures to fill up the school day with classes that meet these demands. So that's one that teachers really feel conflicted about. They say, you know, we'd love to spend more time in the garden, but we have to teach to these tests, and teachers do feel that pressure.
Hmm. How significantly has the time spent in the act of planning, preparing, and enjoying food at the table declined?
I'm sorry, how?
How significantly has the amount of time that we put into our food rituals, planning, preparing, and enjoying food declined?
Well, I think for a long time people enjoyed spending less time making meals. You know, it was sort of cool and fun to just have a TV dinner or, you know, heat up something in the microwave and then get on to do other things. So I think what's really going on, I mean, in some ways you can say, well, people really miss cutting up vegetables. I think that it's only now that sort of the cost of not doing that is becoming clear to people. In other words, people say, well, it's so much cheaper to get something quick and pop it in the oven and then get on to what's more important. And now we're going, well, what is more important, number one? Like, is it watching a TV show or, you know, playing with a computer game? And they're valuing that. But also, I think they're missing the sense of connection that comes from the food preparation as well.
How do food rituals relate to civility and democracy?
Well, if you think, what is democracy? It's a system of government where people are going to disagree. In all political systems, people disagree. In a democracy, you try to maximize the amount of voices that are heard. And, of course, as you know, when we started as democracy, if, you know, slaves had no voice, women had no voice, children had no voice, over time, we say systems become more democratic the more voices that are heard. So then the question becomes, how do people develop a voice that they think should be heard? And obviously you need rules for that. And so the rules of civility are who gets to speak under what conditions. And if you go back to the table, it's like a mini democracy, that in most households, everyone gets to speak at the table, not all, of course. But in general, it's a daily experience where particularly children are given an opportunity to speak and have their ideas taken seriously. So you can't conceive of yourself as a democratic citizen unless you think you are a person with something to say that somebody, adults, want to listen to. So I see it as a daily practice of democracy, of finding your voice, having people take it seriously. Because usually at the table, even when you disagree, you don't want to fight and you don't want to, you know, argue heatedly, although in some households that's highly valued, and because you want to enjoy the meal. Mm-hmm. So you sort of bracket, you know, what you really want to say with, oh, okay, well, there you go again, but at least you can talk and civilly disagree because you don't want to ruin the meal.
Have there been studies of how conversations unfold at the dinner table?
Yes, and as I say, it varies by culture and by family tradition. Of course, in some families, you know, the parents speak and the children are silent. However, in most U.S. families, the norm is parents ask children about their days and are concerned if not all children get an equal time to sort of speak at the table. And, in fact, some families come up with sort of rules about making sure that each child has an opportunity to say something and isn't quieted by the more verbally aggressive child, and the more silent child just doesn't sit there and roll their eyes during the whole meal. So, yes, there's been a lot of studies of some parents seek out the opinions of their children. Other parents don't seek that out, and there's sort of class differences there in higher class families because they're sort of raising their children to participate in the knowledge-based economy where verbal skills are highly valued. They want their children to practice putting forth a point of view and defending it. And in others, they're not encouraged to do so as much.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is political scientist Janet Flemming. She is the author most recently of The Taste for Civilization, Food Politics, and Civil Society. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with comments, questions. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. One of the people you write about quite a bit in this book is Alice Waters.
Mm-hmm.
What set her on course to put forward her delicious revolution?
I think she was influenced by her visit to France as an exchange student, and she was so impressed with how food figured prominently in the lives of the French that they would have fresh bread every morning, and they would get together and have these long, extended conversations over meals in the middle of the day. And she herself was involved in sort of anti-war free speech movements in Berkeley. And when she came back to Berkeley, she said, you know, I think I'll open up a restaurant where we can sit around and talk about politics, but also have good food, which at the time was pretty revolutionary. And so that was the origin of her restaurant, Chez Panisse, which started as a cafe and now has grown into, of course, an internationally known restaurant. And she insisted on fresh ingredients and delicious ingredients, and that if food was served local and fresh, that people would sit around the table and be encouraged to speak and to share ideas. And that's really what she started out wanting, and it's grown into, of course, advocacy for restaurants that have local, fresh ingredients. And then, of course, she spread her efforts out into – she was very impressed when she heard about the garden at the jail in San Francisco, where inmates were involved in a garden project, and she was impressed that some of them, even when their term was up, they didn't want to leave because they wanted to finish the growing of their crops. And so she supported jail gardens, and some of the produce in her restaurant comes from jail gardens. And she's also interested in youth gardens in local schools and has been an advocate for that. So I'm basically impressed that she's quite a celebrity, but she has used her celebrity status for these causes she believes in and has worked tirelessly to be a proponent of the slow food movement and to have us change our eating habits.
Yeah. And she is aware that this is revolutionary. She calls it a revolution, right?
She does. And that's one of the things that intrigued me when I first heard the expression delicious revolution. It was at a farmer's market, and I first laughed, thinking, what do you mean a delicious revolution? But she's quite serious that it has to be delicious. So she said she doesn't care so much that it's healthy. She just wants it to be delicious, which she's very clear about saying, and that it is a revolution in that it's causing us to rethink the importance of food for these larger purposes of sort of civility, and especially she's concerned about children and the eating habits of children, and that they don't sit down long enough to learn how to communicate, that they sort of grab food and run. And that was another big motivating factor for her.
Yeah. What's the response been, do you think, overall to Alice Waters and her ideas about food and coming together over food?
I think she's had a huge influence, and I know that I talk in the book about how some people think she's naive and, is too quick to sort of criticize industrial agriculture. But I think, you know, her ideas have had staying power. I think they have they're sort of winning the argument.
It's kind of a tall order to changed the way we've done things now for a while. How has she managed to have the success she's had?
Well, it's interesting. If you think about it, she's correct in saying we all ate this way through the 1930s. So in some ways, what's happened in the post-war period is what's unusual. In other words, giant agribusiness farming where food is canned and or transported long distances so it becomes sort of tasteless by the time we get it. It has actually been the exception to eat industrial food and food that's been sent long distances and become tasteless and wilted. So in some way, she's just saying we've been, you know, there is a long history of doing it differently. Now, of course, the whole structure of the farming industry has radically changed. But even there, you know, if you read the works of Michael Pollan and other people, there are organic farmers who are making inroads and coming up with, you know, alternative forms of local food production. And in fact, organic farming is growing at a fairly fast rate, and they're commanding higher prices in the marketplace, and consumers are paying for them. So it's not undoable.
I'm thinking of growing up, I sat at the table at breakfast with my brothers and my mother, and at lunch I sat with my schoolmates, and we had actually a lunch hour at lunchtime. This really dates me.
Mm-hmm.
So we would spend 20 to 30 minutes perhaps eating our lunch, and then we were out on the playground for a half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And then at dinner time, the whole family was together, and sometimes that was pleasant and sometimes not.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But today, I have breakfast on my own. I do lunch at my desk,
mm-hmm.
But dinner's a big deal at our house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, in terms of thinking back now to where we are today, and this idea of where we learn manners, there was a lot of that information being transferred to us kids at the table,
mm-hmm.
at home and at school.
Mm-hmm.
And today, if we're a fast food nation and we're grab and go,
mm-hmm.
and maybe we get together occasionally for dinner, how does that affect our manners? And in turn, how does that affect civility? And then maybe you can take it out even further to, you know, what does that mean for us as a society?
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right that manners are learned, you know, they're an art that's learned by observation. You watch people with manners and you pick that up. And if you don't watch people with manners, it's very hard to convince people that they're important. So I think we pay a really, really high cost if, as you say, everyone is just grab and run, because if that's your life, then, you know, why is this important? So two things. One is, obviously, when you get to the workplace, there are some workplaces where, you know, you literally are in your computer, your cubicle at your computer, and you don't need a lot of social interaction. However, there are a lot of jobs where you're at a real disadvantage when you make a total fool out of yourself by being, you know, poorly mannered or not knowing how to carry on a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, we as individuals suffer when we don't develop these skills, but obviously I'm more concerned with the larger civility, which is part of the table is, as precisely you say, there's a lot of fun and pleasure, and then there's a lot of tension because it's like, oh, who's going to complain about their day? Or, you know, you don't know, and that's part of the beauty of it. You don't know when you sit down at that table what is going to happen. So you need practice when this happens, what do I say? Oh, when that happens, what do I say? And if someone bursts into tears, what do I do? Or, you know, what's a fair way to resolve conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that just has to be practiced. And if we don't learn how to civilly deal with these things, and again, face-to-face, not over computer, not over text messaging, which is, they're fine ways of communicating, but it's been at the expense of this other face-to-face. And I think what's happening, much as you say, that people have sort of given up on breakfast and lunch, but they're really trying to hold the line at dinner and or at least one meal on a weekend, where these things are practiced.
Yeah. And if you practice, when it comes time to sit around the Thanksgiving Day table, it should be a lot smoother sailing.
That's right. That's right. And I think part of the fun of this is that that you really don't know until you sit down. Even with family members that you think, you know, you've been with every day, there can be tension. And, of course, certainly at the schoolyard, as you say, to the extent when you sit around, when children sit with schoolmates, and, you know, teachers have a vested interest in these rules as well.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, political scientist Janet Flemming, author most recently of The Taste for Civilization, Food, Politics, and Civil Society. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's take some calls now. First, we go to a listener waiting for us on line one. Hi.
Yes. I would just like to compliment you on your, you know, talk about civility, which is lacking in society right now. And also, I grew up on the farm back in the 50s and 60s, and ladies would, that's what they would do, is cook food, and everybody supported that. A lot of it was farm grown, and, you know, my mother and grandmother did that, and everybody took time to eat. And I want to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I think your food memories are very common. That that this is a valued function, and it has historically been. And I'm glad you mentioned grandmothers, because so much of our food tradition and our wanting to be around the table involves grandmothers as well as mothers. And I think that the big shift with women entering the workforce now is, if mothers and grandmothers can't be there to do it, who should be there to do it? Because it's such a valuable function to have performed, and I'm very happy to hear you say it was a valued function. And now the question is to sort of rethink and reintroduce that value with different people performing the function. And secondly, you're right about civility. I think every hour on NPR News, we hear the word civility. You know, can we civilly do this, or can we civilly do that, or that we've lost civility in Congress. And so it definitely is resonating in everyday speech about, I really think we have a declining ability to civilly disagree. Yeah. So I agree with you on that one, too.
Yeah. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. First, I have a question. Is Alice Waters the Alice of Alice's Restaurant in Arlo Guthrie?
No.
Okay.
That was a different Alice, I think, was in the Arlo Guthrie song. I think she was in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Okay.
And then I'd like to say that one reason I really enjoy potlucks is because, unlike the daily grind of cooking for a family where nobody says, "Wow, this is great. Could I have the recipe?" And if it's not so great, people don't say, "Oh, Mom, that really, you know, expletive
right.
word there."
Uh-huh.
So you get a lot more appreciation with that sort of thing. And then I just wanted to say that, when my own marriage broke up, I had the two youngest children stayed with me, and we did a lot of cottage cheese and applesauce and egg drop soup with canned chicken noodle soup, because so much of the strife had been over mealtimes and over what was served, and I was like, no more cooking for me. But I've discovered that I actually like feeding people. And my oldest and youngest children are sons, and they both are, to one degree or another, house husbands. And the oldest he's 49 and he has a 10-year-old daughter, and the youngest is 30 and he has a 2-year-old and one on the way. And it's very interesting that they both ended up in that role, and especially the youngest. He's really, really good about, he prepares the food, he fixes his wife's lunch, he does the dishes. So things are really changing.
Thank you for that comment.
And I really am enjoying the program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much about the sons. I mean, this is happening all over. I think what's breaking down the gender expectations is people just going, someone's got to do the food, and it's sort of sorting for the people that really love to do food. And there's lots of men who love to do food and a lot of women who don't love to do food, or maybe it's both that love it. And I'm also very glad that you raised potlucks as a form of food sharing, and especially in this recession. People are rethinking the value of potlucks, which I think are fabulous, because precisely as you say, they're a way of everyone bringing something to the event, and if you like it, you ask for the recipe, which is an enormous compliment and a way to sort of connect you, particularly if it's a recipe from a different ethnic tradition, or that opens up a window for you understanding that tradition, and that's a great way to connect to other people. And your comment that even when it's not so great, that's precisely sort of what's going on here about civility. You could say, oh, that tastes horrible, but as you say, you probably just take a bite and go, interesting. And you learn that you're not going to like everything. You're not going to agree with everyone, but you civilly figure out a way to negotiate that relationship.
Yeah. My brothers and my stepbrothers enjoy cooking very much. And my husband, I think it would be fair to say he does the bulk of it, although we share a lot of it. It's just pitch in and do it. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I saw at Christmas time that I thought was really interesting is one of my stepbrothers does a lot of the cooking in their house, and his little son, my stepbrother's daughter received a toy that was a toy microwave oven, and her brother loved that toy, and it was a great game for a good little while, because he would tell us, the turkey's done, and then it would be like, what else are we going to have? Mm-hmm. It was a lot of fun, and I think that growing up, I don't know that my brothers who now cook, I don't know that we would have played that kind of a game.
It's really interesting because, of course, feminists talk about the importance of gender-neutral toys and give children, guys' dolls and ovens and things. And what's interesting is whether or not that happened, we're just seeing this other sort of revolution in men wanting to sort of participate more in the household. But you're absolutely right. The evidence that these old barriers are breaking down, I think, is everywhere around us, caused by larger social forces. Mm-hmm. And obviously workforce participation is huge.
It's also interesting that we're not giving a toy that we used to give to a girl to a boy and saying, here, learn this.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's the children are modeling what's going on around them.
That's my view, that what's much more profound in child development is them watching the behavior of adults.
And they're always watching.
Always. They have very, very keen memories. And, yes, I think that's how they learn.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Well, this is just a fascinating discussion, so thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
I grew up in a household where we were immigrants from Ireland, and my mom did all the cooking and baking and everything from scratch. I was really blessed that I learned that from her.
Mm-hmm.
And my children have now decided that they like cooking. I mean, my sons will invite me over for a special meal, which is just so exciting to have the next generation doing that,
mm-hmm.
And I think that, with people's lifestyles anymore, it's very difficult for people to find time at the table. Because
yes.
They're always juggling extracurricular activities and jobs and things like that. But I firmly believe that, family interactions at the dinner table are like very, very important, as a meal goes.
Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned generations and immigration, because most of the studies show that the first generation keeps its food practices. And I commend you for not being the second generation who rejects them by saying, oh, that's old school and old country, and I just want to eat what we eat over in the U.S., that you've retained that, because typically what would happen is the second generation would not be interested in those food traditions. And then the third generation would come along and say, hey, tell me about what Grandma cooked. I think increasingly, again, with this increased awareness of the importance of food and food traditions, we don't see this kind of generational dynamic, that people are increasingly hanging on to their food traditions from their countries of origin and passing them on to their children.
Well, we've been fortunate in both my husband and my family. We've inherited people's recipe files, you know, which go back, you know, from, you know, like the Depression era and everything like that. And you can sort of see the way people stretched food, you know, in terms of using very little meat or using it for flavoring and using a lot of, you know, rice or noodles or potatoes or things like that to make sure there were enough portions for everybody. And I think that's kind of very interesting. And when we had problems with the economy and people were calling it a recession, I was like, I'm going to dig out those Depression recipes.
You're absolutely right. This is happening all over the country. The people are going back to, well, how did we feed ourselves in the Depression, and the popularity of just simple stews and soups. And there are ways to eat very healthily without spending a fortune. And this sort of wisdom of our ancestors is, I think, hugely important. And there are people who study cookbooks and recipes as a form of, you know, anthropologists and women's studies faculty who study this as very important parts of our cultures.
And my mom always made soup from scratch, you know, where she would save chicken bones to make the gelatinous stock and things like that. And we, in our home now, we have soup at least once a week, you know, with some whole grain bread that I'll bake in the bread machine. Well, I cheat.
Well, that's okay.
I want to thank the listener for her call. I've got one other caller who's waiting for us, and we want to get that call in this afternoon. Line two, Urbana. Hi.
Hi. Thinking about learning manners, I'm just surprised at the number of adults, including ones who are normally very have nice manners, but they quite feel quite free to comment on whether you're drinking skim milk or not, how awful it tastes to them, or something else that they think tastes awful. I just find that very rude, and I have to come up with a good response to a family that I see periodically that does it. I just think it's awful to denigrate what somebody else is already eating. At the same time, I've gradually learning that some people taste things that others don't. Bitter is one of the things that apparently is genetically determined.
It is. There are super tasters, I guess about 20% of the population, who have enormously, basically lots of taste buds on their tongue, and they have a super tasting, and then there's another 20% that don't taste very much, and then most of us are in the middle. So we do, there is a whole science of taste, which is one of the things I write about, that we need to pay attention to actually taste as well, because if the whole point is get tasty food, well, what is taste all about? So there are some people who really don't taste too much differences, and others who taste a lot of differences in food. But then you're right, it's the civility question of, well, what gives you the right to therefore impose your taste on me or tell me what I should be tasting when I don't taste or I prefer this taste? These are everyday questions, and hopefully they will be resolved civilly.
There's one more thing, and that is that Verna Mae Grosvenor, who used to be on NPR periodically, did a cookbook, and she had a TV show, I guess, on Cooking in the America's Kitchen. And I got the cookbook, and she makes a comment at the beginning saying, you know, she used to be a really picky eater. And then she realized that if somebody was offering food to her at their table, that they were offering what they thought was delicious, and that she shouldn't turn her nose up at it without at least trying it and giving it a shot. My daughter-in-law has a rule at her house, which is that kids need to have a no-thank-you taste. She's not an absolute rule. She says, will you do a no-thank-you taste, which means at least try a taste, and then you can say no-thank-you, but you can't, don't just say no in general. And her kids are aren't too picky eaters. And it served me well going to other cultures. I was in the United Arab Emirates, and we had a unique opportunity to, we were invited to someone's home for lunch way out in the boonies, and we were offered goat stew. I didn't realize it was a whole goat until somebody broke the head open and offered me the tongue. And I was the only woman in the group. It was a totally odd situation. And I just said to myself, okay, Vertime Grosvenor speaking here.
Yes.
If they're offering it to me it's and making a particular effort to have me try it, it must be that they think it's good, so I'll try it. So, another thing that comes through in eating with people from other cultures is differences in manners in terms of pushing food versus not pushing food,
mm-hmm.
and the number of times you offer something to somebody before they're... in other words, the right to say, no, thank you, I don't want any more. Some people just keep piling food on, and you're supposed to leave food on our plate, and I was raised where you clean the food off your plate, and it can be a conflict of interest there. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. You want to follow up there, Janet, with any other comments?
Sure. I'm so glad you raised this question of vastly different table manners across cultures, and absolutely the offering of something at a table is seen as an important part of who they are, and when you don't want whatever that is or you can't quite understand the table ritual, that's where these delicate arts of sort of negotiation and diplomacy and civility really come to bear.
And there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Janet Flemming, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Janet Flemming is the author most recently of The Taste for Civilization, Food, Politics, and Civil Society. The book is published by the University of Illinois Press.